to our podcast, Cultivating Kapwa, Conversations with Lenny Strobel. Join Jana Lunan-Mipig and myself, Olivia Sawi, as we have conversations with Auntie Lenny about her past, present, and future, her experiences in decolonization work, academia, ethno-autobiography, and more, as well as her relationship to nature, the land, and all living beings. Kapwa in Filipino indigenous psychology means that the self is in the other, or you and I are connected. We are one. Kapwa means we are connected to each other as human beings. We are connected to non-human beings and to all of creation, and we are connected to the Creator. Kapwa lives in our cultural DNA. So in cultivating Kapwa, we are invoking our sacred connection to each other and to all that is. In our first episode, we discuss Auntie Eleni's decolonization work, her influences, her life in academia, and advice for beginning and continuing our own decolonization. Special thanks to my co-producer, Annie Aaron Sawi, and special thanks to Astrologic for letting us use their song, Here and Now. Hi, everyone. My name is Olivia Sawi, and welcome to our first episode of Cultivating Kapwa, Conversations with Lenny Strobel. I'm here with my sis and co-host, Jana Lunan-Mipig, and our elder, Lenny Strobel. Before we begin, since this is our first episode, I wanted to briefly introduce myself, Jana Lin, and Auntie Lenny. Like I said before, my name is Olivia Sawi, and I am in Tamian Ohlone territory, more specifically Sunnyvale, California, in the heart of the Silicon Valley. I've been involved with the Center for Babaylan Studies, or CFBS, for almost 10 years, and a couple of years ago, I helped Auntie Lenny with her very first webinar, Indigenous Reclamation Through Ancestral Work. I knew that people wanted to hear more from Auntie Lenny, and last November, my wife showed me a post on Facebook saying that Auntie Lenny was interested in starting a podcast, and so here we are. I met Jana Lin through CFBS, and she's involved in many other organizations and projects such as Survival Arts, Raise Pinay, and Journey of a Brown Girl. She's one of my closest friends and currently resides in Lenape territory in the Bronx. She's a healer, a warrior, a teacher, a scholar, a ritualist, an artist, and an awesome person overall. When I approached Auntie Lenny with the idea of a podcast, I was super excited. Then I got a little worried. From the beginning, I was wanting to ask Jana Lin if she could help out. I knew that Jana Lin had studied a lot of Auntie Lenny's and Auntie Lenny's contemporaries' works. When she agreed to co-host this podcast, it made this project a reality. I met Auntie Lenny at the first international CFBS conference in 2010. I heard about it when I was in graduate school at San Jose State University for my master's degree in 20th century U.S. history in a class called The Filipino Experience with Auntie Estella Habal. Auntie Estella Habal wrote San Francisco's International Hotel, mobilizing the Filipino-American community in the anti-eviction movement. I was not familiar with Auntie Lenny's work in decolonization, and I didn't really know what CFBS was all about. I was not familiar with the ethnic studies struggles in Bay Area universities, but my father had been what I learned was decolonizing since the 1970s. As both a second and third generation Filipina with family still in the homeland, I found difficulties finding words to describe how I felt as a Filipina American in the diaspora. And I've also found it challenging to find other Filipino Americans with similar spiritual beliefs, world values, or views. I found a home with CFBS and the people I met through it. I have Auntie Lenny to thank for that. So now I hand it over to JL. Go ahead, start it up.
Hello, everyone. So we want to treat this conversation as if we were in a room together in Auntie Lenny's living room or at her kitchen table, just listening to her lessons and her wisdom. We're going to be just having this conversation here between the three of us, but if you have anything that you want to input to us in relationship to things that may be coming up for you and listening to this work, just know that we're here with Center for Babaylan Studies and with Auntie Lenny to be in relation. So Ate, are you ready to just dive into these conversations?
Sure.
Yay.
Today, our episode is going to be really looking at Auntie Lenny's experiences and her journey in the academics and looking at spiritualism and decolonization and her experiences with academic institutions during her 25 years of teaching. So all the questions that we'll be asking today and what we'll be diving into are around that. Auntie, the first question that we have for you is that many view you as a foremother of decolonization studies and understanding in our communities. What were the seeds that grew you in your focus in decolonization work? And why has that become central to you and your teachings?
Thank you, Jana. Thank you, Olivia, for the introduction. And before I answer the question, let me just say that I am Kapampangan. I am from Pampanga, meaning people from the river banks, Pampang in Kapampangan. And I came to the United States in 1983 when I was 30 years old, and by way of interracial marriage. And as for becoming a foremother of decolonization studies, I'm a little bit uncomfortable with the word foremother, because I feel like I am not a pioneer or a leader in anything. I am merely standing on the shoulders of grandmothers and ancestors who have done decolonization work before I do. Maybe me can say that my work has become visible in the field of decolonization studies in the Filipino American community during this time, you know, in this period. And my focus actually began with the post 1965 immigration, Filipino American migration to the US, because that itself was a historical moment, right? So what were the seeds that grew my focus? Mainly it was because I wanted to heal. When I came to the US, and I wanted to understand my feelings of alienation, my feelings of not belonging, my feelings of not being good enough, my feelings of inadequacy, of feeling unintelligent, And I nursed those feelings for a few years before I decided I would go back to school to try to learn, you know, to understand what I was going through.
How old were you at that time? Just so that we 30. Can be understanding. Okay.
30. Yeah.
Nice. Okay.
Well, because, you know, I had a very good colonial education in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. You know, and you know what a good colonial education means, right? It means everything, all the textbooks, the medium of instruction were patterned after American educational systems. So naturally, when I came here, I had assumed that I knew what this culture was going to be about. I had assumed that assimilation would be easy. I had assumed that since I was very familiar with American popular culture, that I would fit in right away. So I had all kinds of assumptions, you know. And then when I came here, and people would look at me and they would say, did he pick you out of a catalog? No. Or people would look at me and speak really, really slowly and say, do you understand what I am trying to say? You know, assuming that I don't know how to speak English. They would hear me singing with them, singing along, you know, Frank Sinatra, Beatles, and they would say, why do you know our songs? So basically, I was just trying to understand why it was that my assumptions were wrong and why I was feeling the way I did. Mm. And I went into therapy before I went back to school. But all the therapy sessions did not work for me, because I realized that in order for me to get good therapy, then I needed to educate the therapist about where I'm coming from, you know. Mm-hmm. So I finally went back to school, and when I decided to go back to school, I had to find a way of how to avoid the GRE, of how to create a degree program that would allow me to focus on different areas of study, because I only wanted to learn specifically about the Asian American experience. I wanted to learn about cross-cultural counseling, because I thought I wanted to be a therapist, and I wanted to learn how to communicate cross-culturally, So I was able to put together an interdisciplinary studies program that focused on those three areas. And fortunately, I had mentors who guided me down the path, you know. And so I did my MA in interdisciplinary studies, focusing on those. And then towards the end of that program is when I met Virgilio Enriquez, who is the father of Sikoloyang Filipino or Filipino psychology. And we started organizing around around the work that he has done in the Bay Area. We organized Sikoloyang Filipino conferences. And it was in one of those conferences when somebody from University of San Francisco doctoral program in education asked me if I was thinking of doing a doctorate. And I said I wasn't. I was only an MA student then. But somebody, one of the faculty in the International and Multicultural Education program at the University of San Francisco called me the day before the deadline of an application for doctoral scholarship. And she asked me why I wasn't applying. And I said, I don't think I'm qualified. And then she asked me, well, what have you done? What have you written? And what have you published? And I mentioned all of the things that I had published by then. And then she said, send me your application tomorrow. And then I got a 3-year doctoral fellowship paid for through the Office of Bilingual Education and Linguistic Minority Affairs. Wow. So I had... So from then on, my MA was on cultural identity formation of post-1965 Filipino-Americans. And then from then on, through my doctoral studies, I was introduced to Paulo Freire.
Yes.
And he was the first scholar that I read, and he gave me the language for naming what it was that I was feeling, right? And yeah. And from then on, I went from Paulo Freire to Gloria Anzaldúa in Borderlands, Audre Lorde, bell hooks, Cornel West, Fanon, and all of those post-colonial scholars.
Were there any scholars that you looked to at that time, Ate, that were folks from the Filipino community? Because I've had the exact same experience, you know, even as a generation after you... where so many of those radical teachers that I was looking to were similar to yours. Were there any Filipino teachers that you were like, yes?
I think later on I met Caroline Brewer. She's not Filipino, but she's Australian, but she was doing her PhD at the Institute of Women's Studies at the, what was that college? Women's College in the Philippines. Anyway. She was writing her dissertation on Babaylans. You know, she wrote the book Holy Confrontations. And Alicia Magos, who wrote The Enduring Maaram Tradition. Mm-hmm. I really appreciated that. I met Femangahas and of course, Virgilio Enriquez, NVM Gonzalez, Albert Alejo. And I'm trying to recall the name of the other historian, Mila Guerrero.
Yeah.
And so these were some of the Filipino scholars that whose work I've leaned on. And then, of course, later on met Grace Nono. Later on met Marjorie Evasco and Grace Odal Devora. And
I think so those names are so important, you know, for our community to be able to connect with, because many times folks don't know how to navigate and understand that there have been people, as you were saying before, that have been doing this work for a long time.
Yeah. And I also should mention Roji Pepua and Elizabeth De Castro and Professor, they're all professors at UP, Violeta Bautista, and I am still working with those three professors from UP, from the University of the Philippines. And in fact, we're currently writing a journal article on another Filipino indigenous concept of well-being called Ginhawa. And I've just contributed a chapter to a volume on Filipino indigenous psychology, edited by Rogi Pepua, and she is in Australia. But I think she did this through the University of the Philippines Press.
Yeah. So those of you that are listening to us in this podcast, like, make sure to take note of all of these names, being able to follow the trail of knowledge, you know? Ate, I want to actually move to, like, talking about your first publication, which was that your dissertation? Was Coming Full Circle? Yeah. Okay, because as you were talking about the process of you being in schools for your doctoral studies, I started to hear things from from Coming Full Circle. Could you talk to us a little bit more about what brought you through that process? Because we hear how you got to that process and how your healing really led you toward that. But what brought you through it? And can you tell us more about what it was like to have that process be a part of your academic studies?
Like, how did the book come about? Well, so prior to the book coming out, the very first essay that I wrote for my doctoral program was on cultural identity. Like, who are you? You know, very basic question. And I wrote an essay, and that is, I wrote an essay for my class, for my course. And then I sent it to NVM Gonzalez. And Professor NVM Gonzalez is a national Philippine artist in literature. At that time, he was teaching at CSU East Bay. I sent it to him. And the title of that essay was Becoming a Split Subject, on Becoming a Split Subject. And it and he then sent it to the editor of AmerAsia Journal. And next thing I knew, Russell Leong of AmerAsia Journal said, we will use this essay, we will publish it. So that was my very first journal article that was published. And that has been circulated and anthologized and used in as text in many classes. So I was surprised by that, because I was just trying to show him, show Professor Gonzalez my writing. And then he forwarded it to an editor. And then when my dissertation was finished in 1996, I actually started applying for tenure track position. And I got into a terrible car accident because of the stress of applying. And I put aside everything. But there was another elder, Melen McBride, from Stanford Pediatrics or something. And Melen said, Lenny, he says, it's time to publish your dissertation. You have a responsibility to your community to put this work out. And I said, but who would want to read it? You know, I only wrote this for myself because I needed to say something about what I was going through, you know? And so I did, I worked on it, I don't know for how long, rewriting it and turning it into a book. And even after I've done that, I tried to find university publishers in the US, and they wouldn't touch it because they said, well, we don't know how to classify this book. We don't know what discipline it should be filed under, and there are no Filipino-American readers who will buy this book. And then, so then I had a friend, Eileen Tavios, who started getting published, you know, for her poetry, and she had a publisher in the Philippines, and she said, go send your manuscript to Giraffe Books. And I sent my manuscript to Giraffe Books, and then Giraffe said, we will publish this. Wow. So the first yellow book, you know, was published in the Philippines, and then it was brought over here, and then it was sold, and then it was used, and then, but the surprising thing, you see, is that I didn't realize that those who read my book and my personal story would resonate with what I was saying. You know, Delia Aguilar, you know, wife of Ethan Juan Jr., a feminist scholar back east, she said, Lenny, you're so brave for saying what you're saying, for writing what you have written. You're so courageous. And I said, oh, is that courage? Is that bravery? I was just telling my story.
Oh, auntie. But do you understand the impact that that book has had on our community? Like, do you understand that for yourself now, like when you're looking back after all these years out there?
Yes and no. Yes and no, because I usually don't think in terms of, oh, wow, look at the impact of my work. I don't think of things in that way, you know. Mm-hmm. Oh, look how many people have read your books. I usually don't pay attention to that kind of, you know.
Okay. Yeah.
But it is very humbling when people acknowledge it. It is very comforting to know that there are a lot of students, because Professor Dan Bigonia at San Francisco State used the book for many, many years, every semester. So there were a lot of college students that have read the book.
Yeah, so. It is one of the first books that when folks ask me, you know, about beginning their decolonization work or beginning their path of remembering their ancestors, I always tell them to start with that book for themselves. Mm-hmm. So you know, even generations after, it's like it makes an impact on all of us, Ate. Yeah. Thank you.
And I really think, though, the most important part of that book are really the narratives of the participants, right? I think there were 10 of them.
Yes. Do you still talk to them?
Yes, some of them, yes. Yeah.
Did they ever talk to you about how...
confession?
Oh, yeah, do it.
So, Auntie Lenny, I have a confession to make. I actually have still not read Coming Full Circle. But I've learned your work through knowing who you are and this relationship that we've had that's very, very dear to me. And I feel like I understand you, but I still do need to read the book. I just have to say, I love you.
Yeah. I think that the relationships component is like super important to talk about in relation and just in connection to decolonization work. And actually, like, that's such a thing. I wanted to know about the folks that you interviewed, Ate, like, you know, are any of those relationships like still strong? You know, have they ever spoken to you about what it looks like for them to look back at that moment of doing that study with you? What does that look like?
What's interesting is that when we did that work together, I asked whether they wanted to be named or whether they wanted to be anonymous. And they all wanted to be named. They were all willing to be seen. Yeah. So Michelle Bautista, I'm still in touch with her. She's a poet. She's a mother. She became a Kali master and guru or gura. And Teresa is in LA. She's a social worker. We're still in touch on Facebook. And Peter and Cheryl and Luz is in the Philippines now. And let's see. I think there's one or two folks that I have not been in touch with because I don't know what happened to them. I've been trying to find out. But yes, those are very precious relationships that made the work possible, and they have done, you know, this work with me. There was one, I don't know if you know Karen Villanueva.
Yes, of course I do.
Well, she's in our circle.
Yeah.
And she did email me, you know, many, many years ago after she read that book, and she said, I just need to meet you. You know, and Perla Daly was the same. She picked up the book and she said, I need to meet you. We need to create a listserv for discussing this. So she created Pagbabalik Loob listserv. And then, there are many, many stories like that.
Yeah. And then so from that work, then you went into your professorship, right? After the car accident, and were you at Sonoma State the whole time that you were teaching? Was that the first school?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah. Well, I did my MA at Sonoma State. I started teaching on my third year of the MA program. Okay. And then I just kept on teaching through while doing my doctoral program. And then when I was done with the doctoral program, I applied for a tenure track position. And then I was in an accident, then I was sidelined for a year, and then I reapplied the following year, and then I got tenure track.
Okay.
And then it took maybe 5 years, I think 5 years to get the full tenure. Okay. And then from then on, you know, you go from tenure track to associate to full professor. So I retired as full professor,
In that journey of like, of becoming a professor and being in the seat as a professor, can you tell us more about how you continue to centralize decolonization in your teachings? And maybe give us some of the moments with students that made you feel like you need to continue the work. Because I know that, like, as a teacher myself, that's what fuels me moving forward with any lesson is like, do the kids like it? Like, do the students like it? Are they engaged? Then I'm going to keep on teaching this. But if they're not, I'm like, ah, I got to take a step back. So what are some of the moments that really made you continue to centralize decolonization in your teachings in relationship to your students?
Well, you know, I am teaching in the CSU system, California State University system, and our campus is the whitest and the most wealthy of all the CSU colleges, universities. And so you can imagine that most of my classes were mostly white students, and then there would be a few people of color. So my work has always been focused on decolonizing, you know, and when you're teaching an ethnic studies department, you're doing race studies, ethnic studies, you're doing ethnic literature, you know, you're talking about critical multiculturalism. All of those topics are very challenging for white students.
Yeah.
And yet for the students of color, it was very liberating. Yeah. To hear, oh my, you know, of course. So most of the experiences that has kept me going are those transformative moments when a student who comes in, they are seniors, they need to take an ethnic studies class, and they would say, I wish I had taken this class as a freshman, because it would have changed all of the decisions and all of the attitudes and all of the career ambitions I've had, because what I want to do is really da-da-da-da. And then there are students who say, wow, you know, your class just saved me a lot of money from having to go to therapy, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. I know. And I don't have to go into therapy. And I have had students who said, because of this class, I had to divorce my boyfriend or my partner because I realized that I'm not in a good relationship, you know. Yeah. Or students who just find a way to express the beauty of their voice, of their own voice.
What do you think about decolonization work allows people to come to those huge life shifts, Ate?
Okay. Because we're talking about stories, we're talking about big stories, we're talking about meta-narratives. What do you actually believe about the United States? What do you actually believe about world history? What do you actually believe about, you know, what's happening in the country right now? From a sociological perspective, from the perspective of public policy, from the perspective of social justice, you know, what are the big stories that we are told to buy into, you know, and what, when we buy into those big stories, whether it's capitalism, whether it's patriarchy, whether it's, bell hooks said it in one phrase, white capitalist patriarchal system. So when you're dealing with that big story and you talk to students about what are the consequences of these big stories, you know, that carry this that is, you see it in our legal structures, you see it in our educational system, you see it in our social institutions. What are the effects and consequences? And then you see the underbelly of that system, right? And then when you see the underbelly, you see the marginalization, the internalized shame, the guilt, the white guilt, the feelings of helplessness, hopelessness, etc. When you see the underbelly of that, and you know that even if you're a white privileged student, you also are part of that underbelly. Mm. So then how do you begin to change the way you think, the way you tell your personal story, your small story? Yeah, because I've always said your small personal story is always embedded in a big story.
Right.
So you have to see the big story, and then you have to see your small story inside that, and then you decide how you want to tell your story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I feel like, you know, as an educator who also like really centralizes in decolonization, following your footsteps, I have found that being a radical teacher can sometimes be a little scary, Ate, because like some days I'm like, oh, I'm really like working with these kids on these ideas. What if I get fired, or these types of thoughts go through my head? And so I guess one of the things that I wanted to ask you is like, did you ever confront any challenges like that in teaching these really radical thoughts, particularly at a school, like mostly with white students?
Yeah. You know? Well, I've had students walk out in my class and I've had a white male student walk out of class so angry that the student said, oh, what are we going to do? Maybe we should all get out of here because he might come back with a gun. Mm. No. So I've had a couple of those incidents when I actually had to call a security and I actually had to report, you know. Or I've had students of color walk out en masse because they felt like they were not being heard, they were being silenced. And then when I took the side of the students of color, the white students challenged me. Like, they are disrupting our learning process. Why are you letting them do that? You know. And then I had to keep teaching, and then you had to keep. But so far, in all of my teaching years, I have never been summoned by the authorities that I wasn't doing something wrong in the classroom. I mean, my teaching evaluations fluctuated between, well, you get between 3 and 5. You're not supposed to get 3s, you know? But every time I would get a course evaluation in the lower level, like 3.5, you know, instead of 5, I knew how to describe how those scores happened. I said, you cannot teach race, anti-racism. You cannot teach about white privilege. You cannot teach about gender oppression, you know, without getting half of the class disappointed.
Yeah. You
know? So I've had students who would, you know, rate my professors. They would post, she hates white people. Don't take her class, you know. And then there would be somebody else would post, oh, no, she loves white people. No, go take her class, you know. I think it just comes with the territory that, you know. But I was getting that a lot in the first decade of teaching.
Okay.
And towards the last 5 years of teaching, I wasn't getting it as much anymore. Because
why do you think it changed?
Because the generations are changing, you know.
That's right.
The last few years of teaching, I had more multiracial students. Mm-hmm. You know, I had more. I think the landscape has changed, and the discourse has shifted a little bit. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you know, just for us to kind of wrap up this, you know, this session with you, Ate, in relationship to that changing world and the generations that are coming forward, what do you feel like are the things that would be your advice to anyone who is continuing in decolonization work in this time that we're living in?
So one time, Michelle, one of the first respondents, the respondents to my dissertation, one of the questions she asked was, what should I do after I decolonize? Mm. You know? And what should I do with all this anger? What should I do with all these feelings that come up when you start to decolonize? Mm-hmm. And I've said that, you know, honor the anger, honor the grief, honor the losses, mm-hmm. but you also, because this is all part of the work, right? You need to make time, you need to create space for when you are being called to do this work. Because if you try to avoid or escape those feelings, then you're just bypassing, you're not really doing the work. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because when you grieve, when you mourn the losses, when you grieve over your sense of shame or inferiority or colonial mentality, when you grieve over that, then the grief then becomes a question. Mm. You know, how do I heal my grief? Where do I go for healing my grief? Where do I go to recover my sense of loss? And that is also what led me to the importance of Indigenous studies and Indigenous perspectives. Because that is what called out to me when I asked myself that question, what do I do after I decolonize? Yeah. You know, and when I started asking myself that question, what showed up for me were all these Indigenous voices, mm-hmm. you know, literature, getting to know folks who are Indigenous and bringing that forward in my view for me mm-hmm. to consider what it means to be called in that direction. So yeah. Mainly I tell folks, young folks are just beginning maybe to raise questions about identity, raise questions about who am I, why do I feel this way? You know, most of the folks in the diaspora, we ask ourselves that question.
Right.
It's the first thing I say is do not ignore the question. Do not ignore it and do not try to bypass it. Honor it because it wants to teach you something. Mm. It wants you to be healed. It wants you to be whole. And when you pay respects to those questions, then the doors will open up. People will come into your path where eventually mm-hmm. you will meet other people who are on the same path. And that's basically what happened to me is that I met people along the way, you know, that lighted my path.
Yeah.
And that has been the most beautiful thing about this is that I was led, you know, by my dreams. I was led by prayer. I was led by meditation. I was led by people talking to each other about these things. So the early... When Perla Daily set up Pagbabalik Loob Listserv on Yahoo a long mm-hmm. time ago, you know, like 30 years ago, when she set up and the whole community began to have conversations about it. Yeah. And then yeah. a few years after those conversations, she said, you know, I think we should start another listserv about Babaylans. So that's another topic of conversation that we will have, right?
Yeah,
but please, if you're just beginning to come to this work, what does it mean to decolonize? What does it mean to undo history? What does it mean to undo conditioning? You know, what does it mean to undo the stories and the lies that have been told to us? You know, don't ignore the questions.
Yeah. Thank you, Ate. Yeah. Thank you so much for, you know, agreeing to be vulnerable with us in this way and to be in reflection of what you've lived through this work. And for everyone who's listening, we hope that you continue to tune in to the lessons, the questions, and the healing that we're doing communally by listening in to one of our elders speak about their path. Olivia, is there anything else you want to add for this closing of our first session together?
I just want to say thank you, Auntie Lenny, and thank you, JL. And this concludes our first episode of Cultivating Kapwa, Conversations with Auntie Lenny. Join us next time for episode 2, when we talk about Auntie Lenny's story and ancestry and the motherland and the homeland, Auntie Lenny's relationship to the Philippines and the U.S. Have a great day.